listening to Two Sons of Tatooine. If there's a bright center to the universe, you're listening to the podcast that it's farthest from. And here are your hosts, Jonathan and Nathan.
All right, and welcome back to another episode of Two Sons of Tatooine. I am one of your hosts, Jonathan Cohn, and I am not joined by Nathan today. He's taking the week off. But I am joined by my fellow co-producer, who has been on the show before, Mike Self. Mike, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Jonathan. Glad to be back with you.
Yeah, I am glad to have you back and glad to have someone to read with. This is I always enjoy the opportunity to read books, especially Star Wars books.
What, you? You're kidding.
Yeah. So before we begin our topic today, which is on Master and Apprentice by Claudia Gray, we'll get to that. But the first thing I wanted to bring up was we have some book news that has come out since we last recorded. We don't talk about books or news every single week, so it's kind of just piled up all at once. So the first thing I'll talk about is we got the official confirmation that from a certain point of view, we'll be getting a new book from The Empire Strikes Back. We already got one for A New Hope, which we will be reviewing soon, parts it in chunks, but we got that, and it was very fun, very different type of a book. 40 short stories by 40 different authors, and this new thing will be 40 short stories by 40 different authors set in Empire Strikes Back, and I've seen the list of authors, and I'm excited. I'm just excited for Empire. What are your thoughts on this whole thing, Mike? And are there any specific stories or characters that you are interested in seeing more of in this book?
Yeah, I'm like you. I'm pumped about it. As I sit here, I'm looking at my bookshelf, and I see, from a certain point of view, you know, the A New Hope edition. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about from a certain point of view, Strikes Back. I'm very pumped about that. What about you? Yeah, some characters or some backstories that you're particularly excited about. And give me a minute to think about that. But while I do, what are some that you're looking forward to?
One I will mention is Lobot. I would like to get an inner dialogue. I would really like to see a scene with Lobot communicating with all the droids or all the communications devices, but not with any dialogue because he's a cyborg and he can do it in his head. That would be interesting, I think. I'd also like to see what happened at Ord Mantell, because you remember Han having a brief throwaway line about the bounty hunter on Ord Mantell.
Yes.
I would like to see that. I think also maybe I'd like to see they always do something bizarre. So I'd really like to see a short story from the perspective of the space slug in Empire. He's like, man, what did I swallow? That tasted disgusting.
Something is not sitting right today.
Yeah. I just feel my throat's burning. It's like something shooting. It's like something shooting in there. Anyway, so I would like to see those stories. Have you been able to come up with a few?
Well, I thought about the inside the life of an Ugnaught, but we kind of got that from The Mandalorian, right? With was it Quill?
Quill.
Yeah. So we kind of got that already.
It would be cool if we got Quill's perspective during Empire, if he was actually stationed on Cloud City,
that'd be a pretty neat tie-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really just looking forward to the new talent, because with every book, with the last couple short story collections, they've brought in new authors. One particular one that's done a lot recently is Rae Carson. She did Most Wanted. She did a novella for Canto Bight, and most recently did the Rise of Skywalker novelization. And her first story was in this, the first From a Certain Point of View. And we also got Daniel Jose Older, who also wrote it from the first one, who ended up writing Last Shot and is now doing some comics. So it's like a testing ground a little bit for them to test out new authors. So I do like that. Are there any particular authors on the list of the authors that excite you at all?
Well, before we get to that, I did think of something. Empire Strikes Back is kind of the, like a lot of people feel like, and I used to feel this way, and I still think it's a fantastic movie, but a lot of people sort of settled on it as the best, as like the best, the greatest, you know, Star Wars film. And it's really one, like, you have Yoda comes on the scene for the first time. You see Ian McDiarmid as Palpatine come on the scene for the first time. And also we have Vader just doing a lot of Vader-esque things. What I would like to see is sort of like, from a certain point of view, from the point of view of some of the Imperial officers that serve under Vader, because several of them don't survive Empire Strikes Back. So I would like to see sort of just from their perspective, it had to be a stressful experience. You talk about high-stress jobs, being an Imperial officer aboard, you know, Vader's ship as he's trying to hunt down the Rebel base and as he's trying to find, you know, Skywalker. There's just a lot of, it's a high-stress time, and I'd like to see some point of view from some of those Imperial officers. I'm looking at the list of authors now. Yeah, I see a lot of names that are that are familiar that would excite me. Christy Golden, talk to me a little bit more about her. I want to say that I've got on my bookshelf, don't I? I think I have a Star Trek book from her. Would that be correct?
You do have a Star Trek book from her. She wrote a lot of the Voyager books, which I love. They're really short. She's known for writing short books, but she's one of the most accomplished media tie-in writers. She's written for like 15 different franchises, and she's written something like 60 books now. It's crazy.
Our boy John Jackson Miller's on the list. I'm excited
John
about
Jackson
that.
John Jackson Miller. Yeah. I am equally as excited for him. He's, of course, my number one on the list. Gary Whitta, who wrote Rogue One. So that's pretty exciting that they got him involved.
Big time.
He was involved in the first one. And then some people like Amy Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. She is currently the editor over at Nerdist, but what I know is she started out as a podcaster the Full of Sith podcast, which is probably one of the biggest Star Wars podcasts out there. So to see her move all the way from podcaster to writer is pretty cool.
Well, that's got to inspire you in particular. That's a leap down the road that we might see you make.
I can hope. The one person in particular who I will pay close attention to is Adam Christopher. And he wrote a short story for the first one. And he's also known in fan communities for working on Stranger Things. He wrote a novel there.
Yeah.
But what's important to us is that he is the author of the brand new Mandalorian novel that is coming out from Del Rey and Lucasfilm. And I thought we'd pivot a little
nice
bit
segue
to that story.
They call that a segue.
They just also announced a new set of Mandalorian publishing, which is supposed to be across. There's going to be comics, there's going to be picture books, there's going to be, you know, those little golden books that are like 10 pages long with artwork. It's going to be like that. There's going to be art of books. There's a visual dictionary, which I know the visual dictionary always has just a plethora of information, just facts, just listed in there. But specifically, I thought I'd mention two things. One is that Adam Christopher is writing an adult novel, and we don't know what the novel is, and we don't know what it's a character about or the time period of it. And then we also are getting a junior novelization of the first season. And I don't know if that's of the entire 8 episodes, because that'd be quite a bit to novelize, or if it's just of maybe the first 3, because that's like a little, essentially a movie. So I don't know about that, but that one is being done by Joe Schreiber, who wrote the Star Wars horror novels back in the EU. And so they got him to come out of his Star Wars retirement to do this, which I think is exciting. But specifically about the adult novel, do you have a character or a plot or a timeline that you're interested in for that book?
That's a great question. And it's not, because I asked you this when the news broke, I wanted to clarify, it does say it's going to be an original novel, so it's not like the adult version, in other words, that's coming out, I think you said in December, is not going to be sort of a novelization of,
it
of
is not.
The first season. It's sort of going to be an original story. Mm-hmm. I would like to know more about... Oh gosh, I'm blanking on on the character name, but
Kara?
We saw him at the end. He was the one who had the dark saber.
Oh, Moff Gideon.
Yeah, I'd love to explore, you know, a little bit more about his background.
Yeah, I would like to see the Knight of a Thousand Tears, maybe, that they talk about,
or how he got the dark saber. Yeah, absolutely.
I have a feeling, though, that will be covered in the show.
Probably.
What I think would be most realistic is for them to write the novel from Kara's point of view, or Kara Cynthia Dune, because she is going to be in the second season, so she's still going to be integral for the show, mm-hmm. but her story, we know she's from Alderaan, we know that she joined to become a shock trooper, maybe... We're going to get her perspective of seeing Alderaan destroyed, and maybe we'll see her join the rebellion in her anger and just see her just kick a bunch of Imperial butt or something. Like, that's just what I'm seeing.
Yeah, that'd make a good novel.
Mm-hmm. So that, we thought we were going to have a very light year. Originally, if you exclude the Rise of Skywalker novelization, we were only getting 4 young adult or adult novels. And with the announcement of the new From a Certain Point of View and the Mandalorian novel, we're getting 6 total over the course of the year. And then in January and February, of course, we have the High Republic books, which are coming out. They were pushed back then. So this is going to be quite an extensive year of publishing, not another couple months. Is there a particular project that's either been announced... of these two or the High Republic or something that you think you're most interested in?
I'm very interested in the original Mandalorian novel, but probably even more so A Certain Point of View Strikes Back, because I like the short stories. You get a lot of different authors that are going to write those. I'm not going to say, like, for example, with the first From a Certain Point of View that came out for A New Hope, you know, not every one of them necessarily, not all of them, all 40 of them are just riveting. And, you know, that's kind of the way it is. Like, it's almost like a buffet, right? You get to, you know, some stories based on some characters, you know, you're really interested in because you really like that character and you wanted to know more about that. And then maybe others not so much. And then some, like, it never even occurred to you that there might be a backstory for certain characters. And you see it and you go, oh, okay, that's interesting. So I'm excited to see what they do with... to see what these super talented authors can come up with in terms of a short story from A Certain Point of View Strikes Back. That's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I am excited for that. Personally, the thing I'm most looking forward to is just the High Republic, because it has to do with Jedi.
Oh, yeah.
And it has to do with pre-Republic stuff. So we're in totally new territory. And what I loved from the EU that we haven't gotten yet is overarching book stories that cover 10, 15, 20 books. And it looks like that's what we'll be getting with the High Republic. So I'm very excited for that. But we do have other things to talk about on this episode of Two Sons of Tatooine. We are talking about, our main topic is Claudia Gray's Master and Apprentice, which was released in April of 2019, and I will read the publisher's summary. A Jedi must be a fearless warrior, a guardian of justice, and a scholar in the ways of the Force. But perhaps a Jedi's most essential duty is to pass on what they have learned. Master Yoda trained Dooku. Dooku trained Qui-Gon Jinn. And now Qui-Gon has a Padawan of his own. But while Qui-Gon has faced all manner of threats and danger as a Jedi, nothing has ever scared him like the thought of failing his apprentice. Obi-Wan Kenobi has deep respect for his master, but struggles to understand him. Why must Qui-Gon so often disregard the laws that bind the Jedi? Why is Qui-Gon drawn to the ancient Jedi prophecies instead of more practical concerns? And why wasn't Obi-Wan told that Qui-Gon is considering an invitation to join the Jedi Council, knowing it would mean the end of their partnership? The simple answer scares him. Obi-Wan has failed his master. when Jedi Rael Averroes, another former student of Dooku, requests their assistance with a political dispute, Jyn and Kenobi travel to the royal court of Pijal for what may be their final mission together. What should be a simple assignment quickly becomes clouded by deceit and by visions of violent disaster that take hold in Qui-Gon's mind. As Qui-Gon's faith in prophecy grows, Obi-Wan's faith in him is tested, just as a threat surfaces that will demand that master and apprentice come together as never before, or be divided forever. That is quite the epic publisher summary. You did read that book. I thought I'd start out, Mike, with what were your overall thoughts? What were you thinking going into the book? What were you thinking during the book and coming out of the book?
Well, going in, I was very excited. Anybody, you know, the deeper dive into the master Padawan relationship between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, very appealing to those who watched and liked The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. So that part excited me. And you know, they have a bit of a rocky relationship. It's kind of a roller coaster, as the you know, the publisher summary there would indicate. Also, this book deals with major characters. And what I mean by that, it deals with mainstream characters. We're dealing with Obi-Wan, we're dealing with Qui-Gon, Yoda, Windu, Dooku. We are introduced to new characters, Rael Averroes, Pax and Rahara, all the people that are on Pijal. So we get some new characters, but there's plenty of mainstream characters that we've seen on the big screen and we're familiar with and you can kind of grab hold of. And I told you this as I was about halfway through it. I love a good whodunit. I love a good mystery. And the mystery element in this book is very strong. It's fun to try and guess along as you read, even though, as I told you, I'm terrible at that. and I don't feel bad. Like, I never get it right. I didn't get it right here, but I don't feel bad because neither Qui-Gon nor Obi-Wan got it right either, and they're right in the middle of it, and they can touch the Force. So they were surprised by the mystery when it was revealed, and that's a major spoiler alert, so we'll have to decide when we want to bring that element out and talk about it. But I love the whodunit aspect of it. You know, deals with major characters, master Padawan relationship, and here's the coolest part to me that I like, probably my favorite part about the entire book, the Jedi prophecies. The old Jedi prophecies that, you know, that Qui-Gon, when he was a child and a Padawan of Dooku's, he was fascinated and enthralled by these prophecies, and then he kind of convinces himself that, you know, they're just metaphors, and it's safer if I leave those alone. And then now he kind of comes full circle, and he's back, and he's fully on board with the prophecies being real, and the time of prophecy is at hand. And those are just very interesting to me. And it even mentions a few of those prophecies that I thought were really cool. They are alluring, but they are dangerous, because as Qui-Gon comes to learn, you know, it's not necessarily knowing the future that's dangerous, but it's that temptation, once you know it, to try to manipulate it, to try to control it, to try to change it. And that can be what leads to the dark side, and that's particularly relevant when it comes to Dooku and his fascination with prophecy as well. So this book had so many elements that, you know, I knew going in I was going to like it. It had more stuff in it than I even was aware of that I was going to love. And then, yeah, coming out of it, you know, you read that last little after chapter that kind of ties it in really strongly with The Phantom Menace, and yeah, I ended up loving it. It's in the conversation, a conversation that I'm sure you and I will have before this episode is done. It's in the conversation for, you know, some of my favorite Star Wars books of all time.
I would definitely agree with that. And one thing that Star Wars books have is multiple aspects. And sometimes if you just get one aspect good, that's pretty good for the book.
Yeah.
Like, you're happy if you have that one aspect, like whether that's the characters or the plot or the world building or the action or the mystery or whatever, or the romance or, you know, what have it. And if you can nail several of the elements of the book, you pretty much are guaranteed to have not only just a great book, but a well-received book. And this book nails almost every single thing that Claudia tries to do. I have one minor complaint, and it is so minor that it barely affects my view of the book. But other than that, everything I asked for, she nailed.
Yeah.
And so I very much like that. And part of my view is that, so in reading a lot of the EU, there were a lot of middle grade books or children's books that told about the Master and Apprentice and the Jedi going on an adventure. There were very few books for adults that had to do with the Jedi going on adventures and having deeper meanings and whatever. And especially in the canon, up until this point, there were none because they essentially were kind of staying away from the prequel era, not because it's bad, just because they had all these other eras to focus on. And so I was just excited to get a book that had to do with Jedi, that had to do with the prophecies, that had to do with main characters, because most of the canon books have been about side characters. And then to get a book where, you know, you just have a great, like, father-son relationship. That, to me, I'll start off there. The father-son relationship between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan is just the best, I think, in Star Wars. And, you know, both of them have this kind of, like, fear that they're going to let the other one down. At the beginning of the book, I love how it switches back and forth, and Qui-Gon learns that he is being invited to the council and is so afraid to tell Obi-Wan because he doesn't want to leave being his master. And then Obi-Wan finds out, and Obi-Wan thinks that the reason he wasn't told was because Obi-Wan doesn't want him as his apprentice anymore. And they both have this feeling of disappointment of, I'm not good enough for my master, or I'm not good enough for my apprentice. And I just think that it just really endears me to the characters. It makes me value their relationship. Makes me realize they should communicate better, but makes me realize that they're just, you know, Qui-Gon, I knew he was a great Jedi, but after reading this book, he's just an awesome Jedi. So what were your thoughts on that dynamic in the book?
Yeah, you nailed it. You know, Qui-Gon, and there are several moments throughout the story where in his sort of inner monologue, he realizes, wow, Obi-Wan is really a great Padawan. I've got a really great Padawan. You know, when he sees him, you know, rushing, not rushing headlong or recklessly, but fearlessly into battle, putting himself in danger and just throwing himself directly into the fray. And he sees his, you know, moments where he shows great wisdom, and he realizes, I've got a great Padawan, and Obi-Wan's going to be a great Jedi Knight. And even Rael Averroes, toward the end, says, you know, the kid, he's going to make a great Jedi Knight. And Qui-Gon's like, yeah, I know, he's going to be a really good one. But at the same time, every time he thinks that, he is twinged with a little pang of guilt about, well, then why haven't I been able to connect with him? Why haven't I been able to? Why is our relationship, why is our partnership not everything it should be? It's not his fault, it must be my fault. And you see Qui-Gon dealing with this immense guilt. I mean, it weighs heavily on him. And I think we probably need to talk a little bit about, I mean, since we don't have, you know, Jedi Master Padawan relationships, that's unfortunately, it's a shame, in real life, we don't have those. So what real life type of relationship? You said father-son, and I think that's probably the closest we have. But what would it be, you know, as you compare kind of the dynamics and how these relationships work between a master and a Padawan, when you because you have to take into account, you know, in almost every case, Rael Averroes was an exception, and Anakin Skywalker was an exception, and you could argue that neither one of those worked out too well, which is why they were the exception to the rule. But they Jedi are taken at such a, you know, at such a young age that they don't develop any kind of family ties or connections. So they're, for a Padawan, his master, that is the defining relationship. You know, if you want to talk about one-on-one relationships, that's kind of it for them. And I guess it'd be the same as true from the master perspective. So if it doesn't go well, and if it's sort of a roller coaster of a relationship, that creates a lot of stress. And we get a front row seat to that in this book.
Yeah, and one of my favorite lines in the book was when Qui-Gon says, yeah, he wasn't brought in until he was, referencing Rael, he wasn't brought in until he was 5 or 6. And Obi-Wan's just like, I was brought in when I was 3, and they told me I was old for coming in. And he's like, wow. And then you realize Anakin is 9.
They like, really, bent the rules for him big time.
But of course, and it makes sense that all of 3 of the people that they bent the rules for have to do with, in some way, Qui-Gon, in some tangential way, which I thought was funny. What was the first note that you have about the book that you wanted to talk about?
Let's see. I guess we can start. When do we want to deal with the? I'm gonna table the whodunit aspect of it. We'll get to that a little bit later on because, you know, we'll just save that. But talking about the Jedi prophecies, it's fascinating to me because there's this prophecy holocron that is in the Jedi archives, and Qui-Gon is first introduced to it through his apprenticeship with Dooku. It's also interesting to me to kind of trace the lineage here. Yoda trained Dooku. Dooku trained Qui-Gon. Qui-Gon trains Obi-Wan, and you kind of see it's almost like looking back, like in a sense, like Yoda would be Obi-Wan's like great-grandfather or something, you know, in terms
great of... Great-grandmaster.
Yeah, great-grandmaster, perfect. But, so you see, that's kind of neat to sort of trace that lineage, but as far as the prophecies themselves, you know, Dooku became enamored with the prophecies, which I could, you know, I could easily, I mean, I could see how that could happen. You know, they're the old Jedi masters and the old Jedi seers who are seeing these things, and the temptation that's there to know the future and what's going to happen, and you know, the Kyber that isn't really Kyber. When the Kyber that isn't Kyber is found, you know, the age of prophecy will be at hand. And you know, Qui-Gon, like I said, there was an incident, or maybe a couple of incidents in his training when he was young, when he comes to believe that his master Dooku is dangerously enthralled with these prophecies. And so Qui-Gon sort of moves away from them, or at least tries to, but I think in the back of his mind there's always that allure to the prophecies, but he sort of tries to frame them as mere metaphors, and you know, they were seen only through the prism of that particular time of whoever was making the prophecy, and they don't necessarily mean that here's what's going to happen in the future. And then he comes first full circle again, because on Pajal, as he and Obi-Wan are on this assignment, he has a vision and a dream, a prophetic dream, that he is certain is going to take place. And so now he begins to see the prophecies again as actual, you know, real legitimate prophecies that are going to happen. Some of those were cool. And one in particular that they mentioned, and I believe this is not verbatim, but it's, she who was born of darkness will give birth to darkness, was one of the prophecies that was made, you know, ages ago, which... you know, immediately made me think of Leia, who was born of darkness and then gave birth to darkness, which I thought was cool. There are a couple of other prophecies, the most famous one of all being, you know, the chosen one who will bring balance to the Force. That was, you know, that was very, very, that's a pretty well-known Jedi prophecy, but there are others as well. And that whole thing to me was, and Obi-Wan is kind of, I guess his attitude, what would you say his attitude is toward the prophecies? He's a bit dismissive toward those, probably.
Obi-Wan's the Doubting Thomas of prophecies. Right. He was interesting how Obi-Wan was the whole time skeptical, and Qui-Gon was the whole time adamant, and Qui-Gon pretty much was right, especially when you think about some of these. You mentioned she who will be born to darkness will give birth to darkness.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you that that's Leia, and the first time I read it, I didn't pick it up, but on the reread, I did, and... I just think that's so brilliant because she was born to Vader and gave birth to Kylo Ren.
Yeah.
And it's such a great veil. Now, at first when I read it back in 2019, everyone was looking for connections into The Rise of Skywalker. And so we were like, ooh, does that have to do with Rey? Maybe? Maybe she's going to have a child that turns out bad or something?
Okay.
I don't think that's the case. And knowing Claudia Gray, who has written 4 Star Wars books up to this point, 2 of which are about Leia. She wrote one book about Leia a few years before Force Awakens, and one book that takes place during the original trilogy. And so, knowing her history with Leia, I get the feeling that that's what this prophecy is about. But it's just vague enough that it does make you question a little bit, which I did enjoy. Another one that I wanted to bring up was, only through sacrifice of many Jedi will the Order cleanse the sin of the Nameless.
Wow, that one's, talk about one you got to really break down and study. That's a tough one.
Obviously, we have the death of all the Jedi during Order 66,
right.
And that's what you're immediately supposed to think about. And it says, will the Order cleanse the sin of the Nameless? I'm just wondering, who are the Nameless? Are the Nameless the Sith? Is the Nameless maybe actions that maybe it's, I'm thinking, my theory is that the Nameless is the Jedi saw things around the galaxy like slavery and didn't do anything to stop it. And that sin of slavery went nameless. And maybe that's what it's referring to. I thought that one was the most intriguing of them. Before we move on, what did you think about that particular prophecy?
Yeah, that one, I wondered the same thing. Who is, you know, when you think about nameless, you know, are we talking about, you know, the, like you said, maybe it's the victims, you know, the oppressed. A lot of times when we, you know, you think nameless and faceless, you think about large groups of people who are oppressed. And as we read in this book, you discover that, you know, even though the Republic, and this was mentioned in A Phantom Menace, because Anakin was a slave. He and his mother were slaves on Tatooine, and it's mentioned in, I think it's Padme who says, but the Republic's anti-slavery laws, and it's Shmi Skywalker who says, the Republic has no, you know, no presence out here. You know, they, and so slavery is still all over the place, and Qui-Gon is one who kind of asked the question, like, if we're not here to address this issue and to see to it that something is... something as egregious and something as wrong and something as inherently evil as slavery is not done away with, then what are we doing? What's the purpose of the Jedi? So, yeah, I don't know. That was a very interesting prophecy that, you know, that would require a lot of study to try to figure out exactly. And I guess that's the nature of all prophecies, right? They're vague. You don't really know. They can be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
And when on the topic of the slavery, I think it's interesting that the whole, and it's not just the Jedi, but it's really the Republic has this view of, well, if a Republic world government starts enslaving people, we'll stop it. But if someone outside the government or outside the Republic starts doing it, we have no problem with that. And that gets into the different types of political ideologies, such as isolationism and interventionism. And you have the isolationism, which is the predominant one in the U.S. at the moment, which is we think about America first, we don't worry about other countries, which is a laudable at times. You get that sometimes you need to fix your own house before you go to others. But then you also have people like George W. Bush, who had the view of the people of Iraq are being oppressed. We need to go help them. We need to stop the deaths and the murder there. And so she does bring up this tension, and they're really... you see both sides of it. I don't think that Claudia Gray makes you go the Jedi. I mean, obviously you want to intervene, but you understand the position that the Jedi Order is put in, that they only have finite resources. They can't go stop every single slave trader out there, and they have other things to deal with among their own member worlds.
Qui-Gon was so frustrated, though. Like, I think if you could sum it up, he was so frustrated that... this hits at the heart of his frustration with the Jedi Council specifically, but with the Order as a whole, that they had become too attached to the government. You know, they were serving serving the Republic rather than serving the Force. And he thought, we have lost our way. And that's, you know, ultimately you talked about the invitation that he got to the Council, which I think surprised him. It's also, and we'll get to this later, but it was very intriguing to find out, you know, which of the Jedi Masters on the Council was most opposed to him being invited.
Yeah, that was interesting. We can go ahead and spoil that. So that was Yoda. What were your thoughts when you found out that Yoda was against that?
But that's got to be hurtful, right? I mean, if you're Qui-Gon and you find out that Yoda, you know, was sort of argued against your inclusion on the Council. But anyway, that was a tangent. But yeah, as far as I think Qui-Gon's major frustration is, you know, that the Council is serving what has become sort of a corrupt, like, in other words, if it doesn't affect the Republic and the worlds that are part of the Republic, then we can kind of turn a blind eye to it because that exceeds our mandate. And Qui-Gon wanted to say, that's why ultimately, spoiler alert, he refuses the invitation of the Council because he does not want to be a slave to the, you know, for lack of a better term, a slave to the Council or to the Chancellor or to the Republic. He wants to serve the living Force.
And this goes to this concept of you don't need to be part of the Jedi in order to do good in the galaxy. And I get so frustrated when a character uses the Force a little bit and the other character is like, oh, Jedi! And I'm like, Jedi is the group of people that are part of this religious sect. Yeah. But most beings in the galaxy have some form of the Force endowed in them naturally. And so I'm like, that doesn't make them a Jedi. And I would love to see books and comics or maybe even shows of a Force user who just goes around the galaxy helping people. Hmm. You know, someone I know pointed out that their favorite point in Attack of the Clones is when Obi-Wan is at the bar and says, you don't want to sell me death sticks. You want to go home and rethink your life. And I'm like, that's exactly the whole point of the Jedi. You're supposed to just be in the right place at the right time and just help someone out, even if it's a little nudge, like using the Force like that to help someone rethink their life. And so it does make you think maybe there should be more Force users using their abilities for good, which I am interested in. One of my next notes I wanted to bring up was the very beginning of the book felt there's an old book series called the Jedi Apprentice series, which is all about Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. It's like 10 books, 12 books long. It's really short books, like maybe 150 pages, little kids, so big font. And those are, it just reminded me of that because it's an adventure. They're going to stop this hut from selling this stuff, and they're attacked, and it's a misunderstanding. And I thought, cool, that's fun. That's a fun adventure to be dropped in the end on. It's very Indiana Jones-esque to be. This book starts right where the last adventure is ending, and so I thought that was cool. But then you find out that those characters are pivotal later on in the book when the mysteries are coming uncovered. What did you think about that?
Yeah, that was an interesting, you know, sort of you jump right in. They're on another mission. In other words, it's not the main mission, obviously, that the book is primarily about is their mission to Pajal, but they're on this other mission on Teth, and they're dealing with a hut. Mm-hmm. I think the primary purpose, the reason that Claudia Gray kind of started it here, because it's during that mission on Teth, through some of the things that happen and some of the misunderstandings between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, that we sort of, she sort of lays the foundation that, hey, these two guys are not exactly on the same wavelength all the time. And we get to see that kind of happen in real time on a mission. And plus, it's just cool because, you know, you start out with a big action sequence and there's all sorts of stuff going on at the beginning of the book and that kind of grabs you. And then from there, then they get sent on their main mission, you know, for the rest of the book. But, yeah, it was neat how, you know, I sort of thought, okay, so all the events that happened on Teth, that was just a way to get us in. And then later on, Claudia Gray does tie it back in to some, you know, we hear the mention of Teth again, and we hear the mention of Wanbo the Hutt again, and it kind of brings it back into, you know, you almost have to go back and kind of look back at the first chapter to remember what happened.
Yeah, and one cool thing, I'm always picking up on all the little Easter eggs and references, and Teth is the major planet in the Clone Wars movie that came out in 2008 that has where they're going to find and rescue the Jabba the Hutt's son, Stinky. And I just thought that was a cool, and so I could picture where, like, what type, like one of those Bomar monk temples that they were in that episode. I was able to picture that here, which I thought was cool. And there's also an episode of this is a deep cut. There's an episode of the Clone Wars where they go back to Teth, and there is a burial site for a few Hutts.
Hmm.
And so, it's I don't believe it's Wanbo the Hutt or anything there, but I just thought that was a cool connection to bring in a Hutt here and make it part of the Clone Wars. I did love how the miscommunication that's established and helps you establish the characters well. And I just loved how they just got they were just able to do aggressive negotiations by essentially just taking the Majordomo captured and just hold up the lightsaber to his neck. And that's how they resolved the situation.
Yeah. And just for clarification purposes, there's, you know, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan are involved in this, you know, they're trying to escape basically, you know, as they're trying to do so, Qui-Gon gives an order in combat to Obi-Wan. He says, take care of the door. And Obi-Wan, you know, eager to please Obi-Wan, by the book, Obi-Wan, you know, literal interpretation, Obi-Wan immediately jumps over to the side of the room and destroys the controls to the door. And Qui-Gon's like, I meant to take care of the guards at the door. And Obi-Wan's like, well, you could have said so. So, you know, they have this, I mean, how many fathers and sons, how many times has a father told his son to do something and it ends up, you know, his son does what he thinks is right, but it's completely the wrong thing. So that to me did lay a pretty good groundwork of these guys, they're not exactly, like I said earlier, they're just not on the same wavelength all the time.
It reminded me of in A New Hope when Luke's about to swing over with Leia and he blasts the door and he's thinking, I got the door. And then she's like, well, find the controls that extend the bridge. And he's like, oh, I just blasted it.
Yeah.
It reminded me of that. What was the next note that you had on the book?
Let's talk for a minute, if we can, about Rael Averroes, because you talk about a tragic character. He's sort of a tragic character, and then again, he's such an unconventional Jedi. I wanted to ask you, do you think he falls into the category of an anti-hero?
Yes, okay, I would say so.
Yeah, and I'm not usually, and you know this from our discussion of some Marvel movies and things, like the Guardians of the Galaxy are not my favorite when it comes to the Marvel movies, because I'm not real big on anti-heroes. I want my heroes to be heroes. I want them to be like Captain America, for example. I want them to be like,
exactly,
you know, I want them to be like Obi-Wan, who's an exemplary Jedi. And Rael is sort of, he is unconventional to say the least in the way he dresses, in his lifestyle, in his seeming disregard for a lot of for the Jedi rules. He seems to be outside the rules and outside the boundaries, and they make, you know, the notion that is put forth in the book is that they make these exceptions for him because of his background and because of what's happened to him. And I say a tragic character, you know, you can talk about what happened with him and his first Padawan, Nim Piana. Had you had any exposure at all, by the way, to this character or that story before this book?
No. Right at the same time that this book came out, there was another project called Dooku Jedi Lost, which was essentially tells the entire life story of Dooku. And it's a very good book. It wasn't released in print until way later, and so I didn't read it till way later. And Rael is a minor character in that book as well.
Okay.
But
he ends up having to kill his own Padawan. They're on a mission. He makes a choice that was not by the Jedi, you know, code of conduct, so to speak. In other words, it didn't follow protocol. He broke protocol, which he did all the time. And as a result of that, long story short, he ends up having to take the life of his own Padawan because it's hit with a slicer dart, which was new to me, new technology that basically causes her to turn, takes control of her body until it causes her to turn against her master, and he has to cut her down. And now he's consumed with trying to make up for that. And that's what ultimately leads him, you know, he goes to Pajal, he's placed there as the regent, basically running the planet until the queen that he is, or the princess that he's effectively raising, is ready to take over. And he's just kind of a tragic character, but I was curious to know what you thought of him. I don't know if it's as simple as like or don't like, because he's supremely gifted. He's a very gifted Jedi, but I don't know. He was a little rough. He was a lot rough around the edges, wasn't he?
He was. I mentioned at the beginning that I had one small problem that irked me, and that was Rael Averroes.
Yeah.
And it's not that I completely hate anti-heroes, because I don't, and I see the need for them, and he's very much like a Claudia Gray type character. Like, he matches the types of characters she likes to put in books, and his overall rough around the edges, different from the Jedi, is okay with me. I don't like it. Like, I always want to, if I'm going to be writing a Star Wars book, I'm going to be writing it about Obi-Wan Kenobi and Qui-Gon, because of they're the true heroes. They're not just anti-heroes. And with Qui-Gon, yeah, he's a little bit rough around the edges, but it is entirely to serve the Force and to serve his higher ideals.
Right.
Qui-Gon is driven everything by his higher ideals. Rael is not. Rael is very much he likes being a Jedi and where he is, and so he just twists things so that it fits, so that his lifestyle works within the Jedi. So, I hate having to talk about this part. So the one thing that really irked me was I don't like this phraseology being used in Star Wars, but when he gets laid in the book, that just really irked me for several reasons.
Yeah.
Because at least the reason I got on board with Anakin and Padme is because A, they got married.
Right.
And B, it really was like true love, kind of. But with Rael, he has no purpose. It's just to satisfy lustful desires, which I don't approve of. And his whole point is, well, the Jedi Order says we just can't form attachments, so I'm not forming an attachment. And it's like, no, you're doing this for bad reasons, and the higher ideal is I'm not going to do anything because I want to be pure and I want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And anyway, that just irked me a little bit, and I realized it's going to happen in Star Wars books because not every Star Wars author has the exact same ideals that I do. But that just really rubbed me the wrong way. What did you think about that?
I was caught off guard by a lot of, you mentioned the phraseology and some of the things and some of the descriptions of, some of the words that were used and descriptions that were used that I hadn't encountered those before in most of the Star Wars books that I've read. It was different. Mm-hmm. It was new. It was a little more, I guess, colorful, I suppose, would be one way to put it. But I'll tell you this, though. The one thing that did surprise me, again, without giving away too much, and eventually we'll give away pretty much all there is to give when we talk about in the book, but, you know, if there was a moment of kind of redemption for Rael toward the end, mm-hmm. when Qui-Gon asked him what he's going to do, because he's been on Pajal for, I think it's 8 years. I mean, it's been a long time that he's been almost in exile on Pajal, just so far away from Coruscant, so far away from the Jedi Order, no supervision, doing his own thing, and that obviously goes south. I mean, you know, obviously with what happens with Princess Fanry, one of my notes for that I wanted to talk about was just one word, Fanry, !! Because I want to get to that in a minute, because it was just mm-hmm. so shocking. But obviously, he's 0-2 when it comes to apprentices / proteges. He's 0-2. He's really, really big time 0-2 on that. So,
yep.
You know, he mentions it. Qui-Gon asks him what he's going to do. Are you going to go back to Coruscant? And Rael says, I've been in touch with some old friends. I instantly knew that it was talking about Dooku. I knew because one of the undercurrents of the book and the story that's being told is that Dooku has left the Jedi Order and nobody knows why or where he is or what's happening and they can't reach him. And that's kind of a build up towards, you know, Episode 1 and even Episode 2. We see that Dooku has started down that path. I knew that he had contacted his old Padawan, Rael. The part that surprised me, and I was pleasantly surprised, was that Rael said no. Did that not surprise you? When Dooku asked him to come join him and learn the ways of the dark side, and Rael quotes what Qui-Gon told him earlier in the book, and he says, I'm not choosing the light because I think we're going to win. I'm choosing the light because it's the light. And I that to me was kind of a, did that redeem Rael Averroes in your eyes at all?
Yes, so I can say that I like where Rael Averroes ended up in the book.
Right.
Towards the end, I didn't much like getting there. And that's why movies like Iron Man just don't appeal to me, because he really becomes like a heroic good figure by the end of the Iron Man movies and the Avengers movies. Mm-hmm. But I just don't like having to get there and go through all that bad stuff. And, you know, I just like my hero to be the Luke Skywalker, or the Captain America, the through and through good guy to the end, knows right and wrong, all that stuff. And so that's why I'm really, it's hard for me to get on board. I would not mind a future book about Rael long as it's after this period. If there's a book before, I'll read it, but I'm just going to be like, it's not my book, not my style of book.
You made a good comparison there, though, because you can compare Rael Averroes. He's the Tony Stark of the Jedi Order, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's a rebel. He's a playboy. He's, you know, breaks all the rules, outside the rules, but very talented, very gifted. That was interesting. But I didn't know what to make of his character. It was very, I don't know. I'd say maybe he's the most unconventional Jedi that I've ever read about. I think for sure.
And we thought Anakin was unconventional, quite a bit. And it is part, I questioned the judgment of the Jedi. He was raising a child in his apprentice, and he failed magnificently. We need to give him another assignment. Let's make him raise another child.
Right.
I'm like, what, maybe they were thinking that he could redeem himself as well, but partially I'm just like, I don't know. I'm curious about the logic that the Jedi Council was using. Maybe they really do need Qui-Gon. on there. Maybe he should have taken the job. I've seen a lot of people say that if Qui-Gon had survived and raised Anakin, that he would not have fallen to the dark side.
Hmm.
And I think, that would be interesting, because Qui-Gon would have... Because we actually find out in Clone Wars that Obi-Wan knew about Anakin and Padme, but just didn't say anything because he's his friend. But I feel like Qui-Gon would confront him, kind of like Qui-Gon confronts Rael in this book. Which I think is really good. My next note that I thought I would bring up was a line you mentioned, which is just... You know, it's in my copy of the book, it's literally on the back of the book. It's just, it's such a great line. It's Qui-Gon talking to Rael. He says, "It matters," Qui-Gon said quietly. "It matters which side we choose, even if there will never be more light than darkness, even if there can be no more joy in the galaxy than there is pain. For every action we undertake, for every word we speak, for every life we touch, it matters. I don't turn towards the light because it means someday I'll win something of the some sort of cosmic game. I turn toward it because it is the light."
Mm.
And after reading that in the book, I was like, sold! Best Jedi ever goes to Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great quote.
It is a great quote. That is going in my all-time Star Wars quotes, which I'm not a quote person. I don't normally... Like, I have friends on Facebook who have, like, on their Goodreads, they have, like, 50 or 60 quotes from all these inspirational. I have, like, 5, and most of them are just Brandon Sanderson. But this one is deserved to be up there. It's a very good quote. What was your next note that you had to talk about?
Well, let's see. I guess we can talk a little bit about some of these cross-references. And I mentioned one. These tie-ins, I guess, are references to other things in the Star Wars galaxy. There was a reference to Maz Kanata, and this did not play a huge part at all by any stretch in the plot of the book. I just thought it was neat. It's toward the end, and we can sort of also in this course of this discussion we can talk about the before chapters. I don't think you were necessarily as big of a fan of the before. It's kind of like these in-between chapters. Like, you'll go from chapter 34 to 35, but in between 34 and 35, you get a before. You get a flashback. And I was a big fan of the flashbacks because most of the flashbacks focused on Qui-Gon's apprenticeship with Dooku. That was neat to me. But in one of those, we see Qui-Gon contacting Rael to express concern about something that Dooku has done. There was a bounty hunter that was about to kill Qui-Gon. Qui-Gon was a young Padawan. And Dooku basically uses Force lightning, and you know, to subdue this bounty hunter, and it scared Qui-Gon because he saw some darkness in Dooku. So he contacts Rael about it, and Rael is in a cantina on a backwater planet, says the book, called Takodana, and then it references the person that's bringing him his drink, and it's this wizened creature with goggles and beads, and it's like, oh, that's Maz Kanata, and he's in her, you know, cantina. And is that not exactly the place where Rael would be, by the way? That's exactly where he would be.
Absolutely. And I've read this book twice and did not pick up on that. And I'm in a Facebook group where we talk about books, and someone mentioned, before I read this, the Maz Kanata reference, and I was so into the book. And I'll be honest, the next chapter after this was like, I knew what was coming, and I was like, I'm just racing to get there because it's so big. And so I read that, and I just didn't process, oh, that's Maz Kanata. And I just think that's really cool. Reinforces that this character has been a lot of places. It's like, you can tell just about any Star Wars story in the last 1,000 years of the timeline, and you can just pop in Maz Kanata, and it'll work. You were saying... I'm not a huge fan of the before chapters. Not that I think they're bad. It's just this is really nitpicky. And this is weird to me to say this because this is my favorite canon book. So I love the book. But this is just a philosophy that I have. Coming from the EU, all books started and ended all in a linear timeline. And you may have had... So the entire timeline of the book may have been 3 weeks or 1 month. And the advantage of that was that on it, you could put the book on a timeline and you could specifically point to this is all the time it covers. And you don't need to, you can read stuff before and after, but this is exactly where. And the canon, so many of the books jump around. Now, you have the Thrawn books, which literally jump different eras. You have some in the Clone... Part of it's in the Clone Wars era, part of it's in the Empire era, and then you have some of the Aftermath books, which jump around, and you have Lost Stars, which covers the entire original trilogy. And I wonder, how do you put the book... You have main events, but how do you put it on a timeline? This book is easy because 95% of the book is one linear timeline. It just has those befores, and it has an afterward. And I don't like books having befores or afterwards because I like it just fitting into that neat area. And if you want to write, like, a book... Like, if I picked up the... if I picked up the book... The next book about Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan started right after this. It would come after it on the timeline, but you'd read the afterword here, and you'd jump down to Qui-Gon's death, and then you'd read my book, which happens right after this book, and you'd jump back. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's not completely linear. And so that's just a preference thing. I know it's a real nitpicky thing, because it's just a Star Wars book, you know? If she needs to include an epilogue, include an epilogue. Like, and it's a good epilogue, and the befores are good preludes and good interludes, and so it is good in what it is. It's just not what I prefer. So that's why just befores never really... Like, I would almost rather they had just given us a full book of the before and just made it a tie-in with this book or something, or maybe included a short story at the end of the book... As, like, you know, sometimes in paperback copies, they include short stories and have the short story be the befores. So that's just a... Do you understand what I'm saying with that?
I do. I totally get it. Yeah, it does. It can make it a little difficult to place it on a timeline, and you are jumping around a little bit. I got it. As I was reading the before chapter, since they mostly dealt with kind of a glimpse into Qui-Gon's past... you know, because we've seen Obi-Wan, we've seen young apprentice Obi-Wan, we've seen sort of middle-aged Obi-Wan who is, a master to Anakin, and then we've seen Alec Guinness Obi-Wan. So we've kind of got almost the full gamut of him. Really only got one part of Qui-Gon on the big screen, and that was, and then now we kind of get a look back to him as sort of as, I thought it was interesting too, this was brought up in the book, and then I want to get to, I got one more point I want to make before we talk about the, you know, Fanry and the reveal and the mystery that I totally didn't get right. But it was interesting to me. Qui-Gon realizes at the very end of this book, which we come to find out is not the end, obviously, of his of Obi-Wan's apprenticeship to Qui-Gon. We find out Qui-Gon realizes why he was assigned, why Obi-Wan was assigned to him as his apprentice. I didn't realize that young Obi-Wan had an independent rebellious streak. Obi-Wan mentions that, hey, when I was coming up through the temple and I was a youngling and I was younger, that was the rap on me, that was the knock on me, was that I was very independent and I was very rebellious. And Qui-Gon said, oh, well, I get it, that's why they put you with me, because Qui-Gon is always sort of, in a sense, kind of bending the rules. So in order for Obi-Wan, the best way for Obi-Wan to rebel against Qui-Gon was to be a straight-laced by the book Jedi. And that's exactly, and Qui-Gon's like, never underestimate Yoda, never, because if Yoda was the one who handed down that assignment, he said that was exactly why he did it. And they both kind of smile as they realize that that's why they were paired together. It was a pretty good pairing. So
that is I love that point of the book. In my mind, Obi-Wan's always been a rule follower, but I like the idea that he became a rule follower so that he could break the rules. that's just a great juxtaposition. You were talking about references, and I know you are chomping at the bit to talk about Fanry, and we will. But one reference was, remember when they're all in the Great Hunt, or the Grand Hunt as they call it, and Obi-Wan is riding on a Varactyl? Did you look up, or did you know what that was? And second question, if you didn't, did you just look it up afterwards?
I did not look it up. I, for some reason, whether it was context or something, I just pictured that as being the creature that he rode on Utapau in Revenge of the Sith. Is that right?
Yeah, it is totally right. That is the exact type of creature that he rode on Utapau. One reason why he knew it so well and how he was able to ride it on Utapau was because of this. But I just love that because I had to look it up. And it could have just been a throwaway animal that she was creating, but she took the time to pick one that fits in the grand story, which I thought was hilarious. And then, of course, you have the... the great line of the through line of Obi-Wan loves flying.
And then yeah, what, at the end, that was really, that got me, because obviously those of us who've watched Star Wars and known it for years and years, we know that Obi-Wan Kenobi hates flying.
Hates flying.
And yeah. So you start reading this book and it's like Obi-Wan Kenobi, ace pilot, you know, he loves to fly. And I'm like, wait a minute. And then you get to the end and I kind of thought and suspected that something was going to happen in this book that was going to, you know, sort of turn the tide as far as him and his opinion of flying. And sure enough, you know, toward the end, he actually inadvertently, completely beyond his desire or control, ends up piloting, hanging on for dear life as a starfighter, you know, zooms its way through the corridors of a ship. And it's a very traumatic experience. And he tells Qui-Gon afterwards, I hate flying. And Qui-Gon's like, no, that feeling will pass. And Obi-Wan's like, no, it won't. I'm done. And sure enough, for the rest of his life, he hates flying. I thought that was another cool reference.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Before we get to Fannery and the mystery real quick, what do you think of Pax and Rahara?
Okay, so this is interesting. I forgot about them, like, going into the book the second time through. I had forgotten totally about them. And then once I started reading, I was like, oh, I remember these guys. And every EU book, a lot of the EU books tend to have these, like the books about Darth Plagueis. And then there's these little minor characters that are in throughout. And you're like, why'd you create that? Because you need a little bit of you need a bit of a grounding. And also, authors like to be able to create their own characters. And if Claudia Gray had just used all established characters, she wouldn't have that much of a legacy to build on. Oh. Kind of like Tim Zahn created Thrawn and Mara Jade and, you know, a Talon Card. He started introducing all these new characters while having old ones. And Pax was interesting because the whole book kept saying he was raised by protocol droids, but he didn't act like a protocol droid to me. He acted kind of more, I don't know, maybe he was. It seemed a bit odd to me. But I did like his relationship with Rahara, how he's the hesitant, I don't know if we should do this, and she's like, we're doing it to help people. I like that she's essentially like, he's the devil, she's the angel type characters.
Yeah, she's the ex-slave / jewel thief with a heart. And he's the one raised by, but you're right, because he's raised by protocol droids. And what does C-3PO tell Owen Lars? He says, I'm programmed for etiquette and protocol. And Pax seems clueless when it comes to etiquette. So and dealing with, you know, like human interactions. And I guess maybe that's, you know, not entirely surprising if he was raised by protocol droids. But if, yeah, that was their dynamic between the two of them was neat. If there was legit romance, and there wasn't much in this book, but if there was, it was between the two of them. And we do find out at the end, Qui-Gon observes, although it's, as the book says, it's none of his business, so to speak, but he observes that the two of them seem to have taken their relationship from business partners to something a little more than that. But the whole Kyber colon crystal, Kyber crystal thing, that was somewhat interesting as well.
It was. I did enjoy that plot. I like that they took these guys as, like, you know, almost like Indiana Jones, like Kyber crystal hunters, and then they realize that they're fake, but they are like, hey, we're gonna stick it to the bad guys by selling them these fake Kybers so they don't get their money's worth and we get paid for scamming them.
Right.
But we're not exactly scanning them because they are like Kyber crystals, and I did enjoy that aspect of it. You mentioned their relationship. I was hoping for more. And when he goes and rescues her, she makes a comment about it, about my hero. And I was like, yes, yes, yes. And then nothing happens. And I was like, don't do that to me, Claudia. And she does that. All her books have a romantic something in them, and all of them have tragedy in them. So this one didn't exactly have tragedy at the end, thankfully, thank goodness. So it kind of leaves you questioning, but every book she creates that little love interest thing and then pff, takes it away from you. And I was just like, oh, come on, Claudia, come on. Jeez, yeah. So I really did enjoy them. I think they were a good grounding for the story, a good, like, a character for the audience to relate. Even though the audience can easily relate to Obi-Wan, I think they were even more relatable. because they didn't have special powers or anything. But we have kept this portion of the conversation off long enough. So, Fanry and Pajal. We'll just talk about the overall plot leading into that big mystery revelation in chapter 35. What did you think of the mystery going in? Who did you think that was going to be the bad guy? And what did you think when they revealed who it was?
Well, I had all sorts of, I've told you before, I enjoy guessing along, but I rarely, if ever, get it right.
Yeah.
You know, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan have been sent here to basically just, well, to protect the princess, Princess Fanry, who's like, I think she's 13, 14 years old, so she's, you know, about to become the queen of the planet, but also at the same time abdicating some authority as they move toward a more representative form of government. And Qui-Gon is essentially just there to make sure, because terrorist attacks are taking place, there's a faction on the moon of Pajal that is opposed to the direction that things are heading. They feel underrepresented. They are threatening the princess and all this stuff. So they're there on protection detail, and he's also there to witness this, to make sure this treaty ceremony takes place and gets signed so that this hyperspace corridor can open through Pajal and change the fate of that planet and some of the surrounding planets, et cetera, et cetera. And then, so the whole thing, you're trying to guess along as a reader, who's behind these terrorist attacks? And you have this group called the Opposition, which is hilarious because it's a group of former actors. Actors presumably turned, you know, if it's a theater troupe now with guns, turned terrorist. And they're supposedly perpetrating all these bombings and shootings and all this other stuff that's going on, you know, all over the planet. And then you have this other mysterious group, the Black Guards. Are the Opposition and the Black Guards in league with one another? Are they one and the same? Are they two different groups? And all the while you're trying to guess who is behind the plot. To derail the treaty ceremony, who is behind the plot? My first thought was it had something to do, obviously, the bad guys are Zerka Corporation, right? Zerka Corporation. I didn't trust anybody that had anything to do with Zerka. So that means, you know, Merritt Cole was the primary supervisor there. Didn't trust her. Very suspicious of her and their motives. I even considered Rael Averroes because I didn't know how far gone he might be. I thought maybe something was going on with him, but he really did seem devoted. In the end, he was too devoted, so devoted to Princess Fanry's well-being that he completely lost sight of everything, including who she might really be. And I told you, the theory that I finally settled on right before I got to the part where I knew it was about to be revealed was basically the Queen's handmaiden, Katie. And I thought, okay, we've read very practically nothing about her. She's going to be the out-of-left-field shock reveal that she's behind this plot to kill the princess. And then I was kind of right, but mostly wrong, because Katie was involved, but she was involved in a plot with the princess, and it ends up being Princess Fanry who is the one behind. She's in league with the Royal Guard, Captain Darren and the rest of the Royal Guard, and they basically hijack the treaty ceremony. And lo and behold, it turns out that this little 14-year-old girl decides that, you know what, I'm not quite ready to give up absolute power. I think I will stay in charge. And it blew my mind. It totally blew my mind when I read it. There's that one line where it's revealed where it says, Qui-Gon was watching something else. He almost missed Fanry stabbing the Skykeeper and with a ceremonial blade. And I'm like, what? I had to go back and read it again. So it was a total shock to me. Was it a shock to you?
It was the first time, it was a total shock. Didn't see it happen. There were a few things I remembered from this book, and that was one of them. When I went back to read it the second time, and so I started looking for the clues. And
were
they are there.
They are there.
Because you notice when the dart is shot in Fanry's room, they unequivocally state the only people who had access to the room were Fanry and Katie. And they say even the guards didn't even have access to it. And then when they talk about the opposition, Fanry makes sure that Darren goes along and is part of looking into it a little bit. And I did. And so you make sure he says the princess ordered me here. And
yeah,
you put those two things together. I was able to see, oh, I see this coming. And also, did no one ask if she wanted to sign over her power? Like, it just seems like they just were like, Well, I guess I'm taking over being her her parent in as Rael as the regent. I guess we're going to sign this treaty that takes away her power. It's like, wait, she still is the absolute monarch. She still might not want that.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, really, you guys just don't communicate well. You should have asked her if she wanted to give up her power, because obviously she didn't.
No, and there's she has a, like, to me, I read the line and it gave me chills. It's like a bone-chilling line. I would love to see it acted, you know, on the screen, but Fanry, after she's been exposed, and obviously they've hijacked the treaty ceremony, and, you know, she, you know, now it's all come to light that she's behind all this, and Rael is seeing her in a completely different light, obviously, than he ever has, and I think it's Qui-Gon who says something about, you know, is there still a possibility that we can negotiate peace? And she says, I've seen the cost of peace. I prefer war. And I'm like, yeah. Oh my gosh, this just, that was such a great line, because it's like, the book says that she says it with like this look in her eyes, just this, you know, her eyes are like glittering as she says this. It's like, wow, this is one power-hungry, you know, young lady. So it was a huge twist, but totally, you know, the twist like that, you want them to, you have to strike the balance, because you want them to be a shock, and you want them to be, a huge reveal, but it also has to be credible. It has to be, like, believable, and I thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was credible and believable, and I just love the image of, like, this 14-year-old just ordering all this stuff around. I don't watch the show Game of Thrones, but I know towards the end of Game of Thrones, there's this little girl who is in charge of this town, and they're fighting against the bad guys, and you just see her with this, like, sword that's just too big for her to wield, and she just goes swinging in, and that's what I imagine with Fanry. Like, she's not prepared for any of this.
Yeah.
And that's why she's not good at shooting down the people. I just thought that was so fun. And also, I'm just thinking, if she was smarter, she would have just become queen and just not signed anything. Just been like, you know what? I'm tired. I'm going to bed. And they'd be all like, right. What? And then she's like, yeah. And they're like, but you didn't abdicate anything. And she's like, you're right.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
She has absolute power now as a 14-year-old, and she doesn't even need to kill anyone.
Right.
And so, anyway, and then she can make her laws outlawing Zerka or kicking out the region or something. And so I was just like, you could have done this easier, and you would have kept your throne.
Fanry. Right.
I do want to see, I want Master and Apprentice 2, The Rise of Fanry, or The Revenge of Fanry.
Yeah.
I do want that story, because I'm imagining her going to a university, as they said they would, and then her getting totally radicalized.
Well, like being that, like, that part blew my mind when they talked about, okay, what's going to happen. I'm like, wait a minute, are you telling me that when she hits 18, which is basically 4 short years from now, she's just free and clear of all this that she tried to do and did? I mean, she, first of all, attempted murder because she stabbed the Skykeeper. You know, there's treason, probably. I mean, there's all sorts of things that she's guilty of, but because she did them as a minor when she turns 18, it's like, oh, okay, well, she gets, you know, blank check, you know, fresh start. And then Katie was going off to university as well. Now, Katie does end up being the one who stops Fanry, because there's an uprising on the Zerka ship, and there's a slave uprising, and those people are breaking free. Fanry was ready to kill all of them. She was ready to kill all of them at any cost, just to destroy Zerka Corporation. And Katie puts a stop to that, and that's how they end up. You know, they sort of take control back from Princess Fanry. But yeah, I'm down with Master and Apprentice 2, The Rise of Fanry, the Revenge of Fanry, or something. I mean, let's get started on that.
Yeah, and that was just a great scene where, once Rehara was taken, I loved how Pax was just so determined to get her back. And he went from being the guy who didn't want to be involved at all to absolutely is driving the whole story. And I love when he storms in and Qui-Gon's talking with Obi-Wan and Captain Darren, is just an average Joe. He's just trying to save Fanry. He's just trying to be a good captain. And they talk about something about the Zerka, and he says, is she a slave? And it mentions Pax just giving him this dirty look. And then he says, I won't say anything. And he's like, oh man, that, like, he just gives, I just want to see that stare, like that death stare that Pax gives him.
Yeah.
And then the Pax is like, we're going in. And like, they're like, they go through the ship, and
Obi-Wan's like, I sort of assumed Obi-Wan would be the one who actually goes into the ship to find Rehara and rescue her, and Pax is like, no, I got this. You stay here because, you know, we're gonna need to make a quick getaway when we get back. But yeah, he really did kind of all of us. You're right. He went from being this detached, aloof, I'm just here to make a profit. He went from that kind of a guy to being all of a sudden now he's emotionally invested very much in Rehara, and that was a cool little rescue operation that they pulled off.
Yeah. You just said that, and I think an alternative name that would have been funny for this book, like a spoof name, would have been Prophet and Prophet.
Oh, there you go. The two Prophit and Propatt. Yes, very good. Yeah.
I really thought that could have been an alternative. But yeah, how he switches between that and when he just goes in and saves her, and then she's like, nope, we're taking all of us with us. It's just like, it's kind of like... It's almost like 101 Dalmatians when they're coming just to take the 15 and then they realize they have 100 dogs and they're like, oh, we have to take all of them now.
Right.
Oh, I thought that was a great, great scene. What did you think of Obi-Wan turning on Qui-Gon and calling the council behind his back? I was shocked and I was like, no, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of... You know, because at the beginning, the big thing is, you know, Obi-Wan finds out from someone else, from the Chancellor, inadvertently, that Qui-Gon has been invited to the Council, and he feels betrayed, right? He feels like, oh, why didn't my master tell me about this? And then at the end, it's kind of like turnabout is fair play, because Qui-Gon finds out, although Obi-Wan does tell him, I contacted the Jedi Council. Because Qui-Gon's thinking, the treaty ceremony's off, right? He sees all these people bustling about and preparing for the treaty ceremony, and he's like, wait a minute. I did say that I'm not overseeing this and that this is not happening, right? And so he's like, what's going on? Did they send somebody else? And then Obi-Wan's like, well, actually, I contacted the council and they've appointed me to oversee the... And it's like, oh, so it's like, yeah, it's almost like there was a, you know, sort of, a, like I said, a turnabout's fair play. But, you know, but yeah, it did seem like a breach of Master Padawan protocol a little bit for Obi-Wan to take that step to... it almost seems like something that Qui-Gon would never be able to get past, but thankfully he did.
Yeah, and I like that Qui-Gon has this moment of like, man, I've been trying to get you to break the rules for so long, and he's like, I really want to be proud of you, and I really want to be angry with you at the same time.
Oh, and he gives him a withering remark where he says, you have just sealed this planet's future, you've written this planet's future in blood, is what he says, and then he like storms out and leaves, and I'm like, ouch, that is harsh.
It is, but it shows how dedicated they both are, and it just shows that they're a good pair, because they temper each other in different ways. Obi-Wan is the principled follow the rule person, and Qui-Gon is the principled ideologue. And you combine the two, and they're just a great team. And that's what I think makes this book so powerful. Before we end, I do want to talk about a few more of the prophecies, because the prophecies are a great part of this book, one of your favorite parts, mine favorite part as well. One prophecy, the danger of the past is not past, but sleeps like an egg. When the egg cracks, it will threaten the galaxy entire. And to me... I thought of this as the egg is the Sith.
Yeah.
Is that what you thought when you were reading that?
Yeah, I think that's a direct reference to the Sith, because the Sith have presumably at this point been extinct for millennia. So that's kind of what I thought about. I thought that was fairly straightforward, but again, prophecies are so rarely straightforward that it may not be at all, but...
Yeah, then there's one more that... I literally don't know what this means, and it's entirely possible that this prophecy has already come true, and totally possible that we haven't seen it yet, and that's, when the Force itself sickens, past and future must split and combine. Wow. I'm just like, that's a deep quote, and I have no idea. Like, maybe no, that has to do with Rey and the Force Awakening and... split. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with like the lightsaber splitting in Last Jedi. Maybe it has to deal with.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that's just so ominous, and I can't wait to get confirmation in the future on that. Do you have any theories on that?
No, not right off the top of my head. That's another one. Like we said earlier, the one about she who is born of darkness gives birth to darkness. I was like, okay, that's Leia. And then there's some that you go instantly. This is probably what that's referring to. And then others you have to read 5 times just to vaguely understand what it even says. And then, yeah, I have no idea what that's about. It says, when the Force sickens, I don't know if the past and future must come together. I don't know if that has something to do with, if that's another Chosen One related prophecy bringing balance to the Force. I'm not sure about that.
I don't know either. But
I tell you what was cool,
like,
though.
It.
I loved the last line of the book, and I don't mean the after chapter, which I also liked, but the last line of the actual book. No, I'm sorry. It is the last line of the after chapter. It's on Naboo, and it's where it's the funeral for Qui-Gon, which we see at the end of Phantom Menace, and they've Claudia Gray has fast-forwarded in time here, and you see Padme or Queen Amidala coming in to kind of comfort Obi-Wan as he's spending some last moments with Qui-Gon's corpse. And, you know, looking at him one last time, and the last line, because Qui-Gon has said, remember the last thing he said to him was, you know, the boy is the Chosen One, train him. And Obi-Wan says, he gives him his promise that he will do that. And then we see him here right before they're about to have the funeral. And Obi-Wan says, I will do everything for him that you would have done. And then the last thing he says is, I choose to believe. And what I think he means there is, whether or not Obi-Wan actually believes in the prophecy, he believes in Qui-Gon. And if it's like the transitive property of trust. I go back to, I'll use a Harry Potter reference where Lupin is, you know, nobody trusts Severus Snape. And Professor Lupin's like, I trust Dumbledore, therefore I trust Snape, because Dumbledore trusts Snape. This is like Obi-Wan saying, look, I don't know if I believe in this prophecy, but you believe the boy is the Chosen One. I choose to believe, if not in the prophecy, then in you. And I thought, you know, Obi-Wan's belief in his master and his belief in Qui-Gon was unshakable. And that ultimately, of course, is what led him to train Anakin.
Yes, that is a great line, and it's filled with meaning. It's a great line to end the book on. It would normally be a great line to end the podcast on, but I do have one more note that I have to get in. It's sad that it's not that we didn't save that one, but my last note is a line that Obi-Wan says to Paxen Rehara, and I just think this is the most fitting line for today's climate at the moment, with all politics and whatever. He says, people are more than their worst act. And I was just like...
Yeah.
Wow, that is very poignant, very very well said.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's it. Aren't we grateful that people are more than their worst act?
Yeah, otherwise we would all be in big trouble. There would be no statues to anyone.
That's true.
Yeah. That's a good place to end it on. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we will announce our topic for our next episode. All right, so Mike, do you want to announce what our next topic, as in the next book that you and I will be recording and talking about next month?
Absolutely. At the beginning of this episode, we talked a little about A Certain Point of View Strikes Back. It's some 40 different stories, short stories by 40 different authors pertaining to The Empire Strikes Back. And we're going to take the first 8 of those and kind of break those down. So I'm very much looking forward to getting into that.
Yeah, from A Certain Point of View, or for New Hope, as we call it, FACPOV, which is a great acronym for it. It's really good, and there are different sections. Like, the first section is amazing, and the second section is a little, and then 3, 4, and 5 is, ooh. So I'm interested in breaking those down by 8s. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then, of course, our next regular episode will be myself and Nathan. We will talk about our expectations for Mandalorian Season 2. And let me tell you, that's going to be a fun episode. We are talking about theories, we're talking about potential spoilers, things that speculation, all that stuff, and whether or not is Ahsoka going to be in it. We will talk all of that and more. But until next time, I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Mike.
And thank you for listening to Two Sons of Tatooine.